All right, everyone. It's Wednesday, hump day, October 9th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and not Ken Barnes. It is Yom Kippur. Fred Portnoy, our fabulous, fabulous. What's your title now? Director of Engineering? God? Whatever. He's gone. He's just shaking his head going, you stop it, Arnie. And, it's a spectacular fall day. Just let me say this. It's just absolutely beautiful. We're beginning to reach the beginning of peak color, even down in Concord. I drove my young Pakistani student who's going to the law school at UNH Law to a little store yesterday. And she was just – she's like, it is so beautiful here. It is so beautiful here. And I have to admit, it is so beautiful here. So we are very, very lucky to live in a place. And I'm thinking about the Kurds, and I'm thinking about the Syrians, and I'm thinking about what we've done with Turkey, and I'm beside myself, and I'm thinking about the Ukraine, and I'm thinking about the world, and I'm thinking about China and Hong Kong. Oh, God, I'm so lucky to live where I live. Now I have to make sure that we can expand this kind of opportunity and beauty everywhere. All right. Before I get to our first guest with a really wonderful story, I saw a piece at the Boston Globe. It was an opinion piece, and it was entitled, Two-Thirds of American Millennials Don't Know About Auschwitz. A state bill would help. So I posted it on my Facebook page, and I wrote, if we don't know history, this story at the Globe should make us all reevaluate our political leaders' passion for demanding greater and greater emphasis on math and science without the foundation of historical knowledge, social studies, basic civics, and philosophy that ensure a society capable of discerning right and wrong. On a similar note, how many know that our government established Japanese intern camps during World War II? It was the forced relocation and incarceration in concentration camps of about 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, most of whom lived on the Pacific coast. When you are left ignorant of our inhumanity and shame, you are destined to embrace it again. And I have a book, Fred, and the book on my coffee table, and I take it out and I put it back and I take it out and put it back, is entitled Un-American, and it's pictures from those Japanese intern camps. It is one of the most unbelievable black and white series of photos. All right. I'm getting to admire Bob Henley more and more and more for the stuff that he writes at Salon.com, which is I'm so glad he writes there because I get to find him. And Bob Henley has written and reported for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS Money Watch, and other outlets. He is now a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and the civil service in New York City. One of our people that work at our radio station, Bob, is a librarian. And I said, this story should intrigue you today. And it's entitled, As the Welfare State Decays, Public Libraries Become Sites of Social Trauma. With no commons anymore, many homeless and struggling people find refuge at public libraries. Thank you for writing this piece. Thank you for reminding us. Thank you for adoring librarians for so many more reasons than just standing up for freedom of speech and the protection of those institutions, but for people to begin to realize why libraries have now become a refuge for the homeless. And this is a tragic story on so many levels, and I'm so glad you wrote it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I would say that I think I owe a lot to libraries. Coming up as a working class kid in a large family, a single parent, it was the place that whatever you were dealing with went away for a certain period of time, and you were able to actualize and imagine your own future, which would surely be better than your current circumstance.
Right, exactly. And it was funny, I posted your story on Facebook and I said something to the effect about the fact that this is kind of like the canary in the coal mine. You know, this, if you understand what's going on here, you will understand the tragedy of our failure to make the radical and essential investments we need to make in our society. And one of the women who posted said to me, she said, oh my God, Arnie, I was just talking with my kids about this. So people are beginning to sort of notice. Now the question is, tell the story of our public libraries and why libraries, of all places, have become the refuge for the homeless. And I think the idea that one of the nuggets in your story was we don't have a lot of shelters, but we do have a lot of libraries.
Right, right. I would say that first, I owe a lot to this film by Emilio Estevez called The Public,
right,
which I urge people to, I think it was, kind of came out in 2018, but then was released in 2019. There was some buzz around it, I guess, back in April. Mother Jones had a good piece on it. And basically what it does is it looks at Cincinnati and the idea of the conceit of the movie is that there's a supervisor of the library played by Mr. Estevez, who is in this difficult position where in the mean streets of Ohio in the winter, it's gotten so cold that there's about 100 homeless people that seek refuge in the library. And he's presented with this really difficult humanitarian choice of how to respond when one of the homeless folks comes up with the idea that on this particular night, they're just not going to go and take over the library. And this sets into motion a series of things that are from, you know, very... very revelatory, and as the Alec Baldwin plays the hardened detective, police negotiator, who's on the other side of this conflict, and I won't get into the plot twists and turns, but it just lays out very poignantly this moment in 21st century America. And I will say that this deterioration is the consequence of things that have been in motion beyond the political cycle. And I think that's one of the problems with our current reporting, is that everything is put into terms of this cycle and this blood sport called presidential politics. And so this permits the broad slide of society to continue unabated, because it doesn't fit into the paradigm of what SNBC, NBC wants to talk about, what Fox wants to talk about, but that doesn't mean that it's not important. And at the same time, I'm sad to report the death of local journalism. So you don't have any kind of feedback loop giving any kind of reflection on the actual circumstance of the American people as they're living it in Martin Luther King Boulevard or on Main Street.
So one of the you mentioned the movie The Public, but there's also you interview or at least you comment on Ryan Dowd, who's the author of the book, and I want people to hear the title of the book, The Librarian's Guide to Homelessness: An Empathy-Driven Approach to Solving Problems, Preventing Conflict, and Serving Everyone. Listen again, The Librarian's Guide to Homelessness. This is written for librarians. I mean, is this part of the coursework? Here's what I would love to know, Bob. I would love to go to a library school and ask them how often they talk about this as they prepare librarians to go out into the world. How many people do they take a view at the Boston Library, the New York Library, or the Cincinnati Library? How many, I mean, are we being honest with these people as they're preparing to go in that they're now going to have to be so much more than someone who understands books and how to research, that this is also going to be sort of thrown at them whether they're prepared or not?
Right. Well, I think that it looks to me like the American Library Association did have a very thoughtful accounting of this phenomenon. One of the things that we need to, no examination of this difficult humanitarian crisis is complete without explaining how it got here.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm 64. I started reporting when I was 17. I would say somewhere around my 30s, Geraldo Rivera made a reputation for himself reporting on the horrible conditions that were in state mental hospitals,
right,
with
let's
individuals
start there.
Tethered
exactly.
to their beds. And so there was a national reconsideration of, as well there should be, as there should have been, of the mentally ill, severely mentally ill, and how we treat them in society. And so there was a broad liberal, for turn of the phrase, notion that the best thing to do would be to deinstitutionalize people.
Right,
and
right.
so we did that, and the prescription that came out of that was the idea of establishing group homes. that we had a notion that it would be better to have more decentralized, community-based institutions where people could live a normal life. Well, the truth is, we really don't like people who have any kind of problem, and we surely don't want them living next to us. And so, as so often happens, very few of these homes were built.
Right.
And as a consequence now, we have a significant percentage of 2 million individuals who are homeless, a significant hundreds of thousands of those folks, are severely mentally ill and are left to languish in the streets, in the subways, in the jails, in any number of places, all for the great crime of just being mentally ill. And it sets into motion a series of things that have catastrophic consequences, and I don't even think Congress is talking about it. I don't even think it makes the evening news, except in isolated cases, like I report, where a beloved figure in Fort Myers, a librarian, 69, was stabbed to death by a homeless person he was trying to help.
Well, you know, Bob, the only time we talk about mental illness is when there's a mass shooting.
Right.
The only time. Let me repeat that. The only time. And, I mean, the numbers in your piece are staggering because they're not just numbers about libraries. They're numbers about prisons. They're numbers about what happened as a result of deinstitutionalization. It's going to sound crazy, but I'm going to make an analogy. So when I was running for governor, a lot of people were really happy about the fact that they were closing all the paper mills in the North Country. And they're like, Isn't this wonderful? I mean, look at the pollution, yada, yada, yada. And I said, really? And where do these people work? Where do they go once the mill closes? And I care about climate change, and I care about the pollution, and I care about all these things, but I also care about the human life. I said, and as we're talking about these, you know, these places closing, what we have to do is, what's the bridge to the next place? Well, as they talked about, you know, deinstitutionalizing, and I served on the State Institution and Housing Committee back in the early 1980s, so we were looking at
Of course I did.
And so we were looking at this deinstitutionalization. That was part of my job, all right? And I remember saying, but there are a couple of things. One, is the money going to follow them when they leave? No. Where are they going to go? Nobody had the answer to that. But more importantly, what kind of healthcare system did we have to embrace them once they left the institution where, you know what, unless we have some kind of universal healthcare system, they're going to slip through the cracks because they're not going to have the card with them. They're not going to know where to go. They may think they can get a job again and then find out that they can't. I mean, all these things, you don't just, you know, open an institution and say leave without realizing all the complications of what will actually incur once you go.
Oh, right.
God.
So, yeah, I mean, the idea of having humanitarian-based public policy, well, I mean, we're in a different country now. But the reality about this has now been brought into base relief with the murder over the weekend just a half mile from here of four homeless individuals in a single evening.
I know. So let's explain why libraries, from a homeless person's perspective, make so much sense. It's not just that it's a warm place. Remind everyone, what is it about a library that this really is? It's an oasis.
Right. It is also a place in the sense, as I said when we were first speaking, the idea that this is a place where whatever immediate misery you're in, you can escape. Because you are in this state of inquiry, this state of self-improvement,
right. This
state of being around other people where as long as you're polite and observe a certain modicum of civility, you can be without being harassed.
Exactly.
And that's the kind of place that is, it's therapeutic. It also gives you a frame of reference because one of the things about homelessness is loneliness.
Loneliness.
And if you've had protracted conversations with people on the street, there's one of the difficult challenges is that you really do become unmoored from the things that make life work that we take for granted, the ritual of preparing a meal with people, the ritual of being in a place where you're regarded and you're cared about. And so the library becomes that fallback, that essential safety net that provides all those things that makes being human worthwhile.
Well, and one of the other things that is mentioned in the article, and I've actually talked to librarians about this, and so it's a place where you can plug in your cell phone.
Right.
Because there are no plugs
the
on the street.
The creature.
Right. It is a place where you can actually access the internet because you
and
don't
you
have
use
a place.
Use the restroom
and wash your clothes in the restroom
and
shower basically almost in the restroom. Because again, and then there's another thing, and I'm beginning to notice this. So there's a significant amount of mental illness in my family. And one of the triggers that is really difficult for people who are, you know, either on the spectrum or have some kind of a mental illness is noise. And what people so don't understand is if some of these people have some significant mental health challenges.
Very good point.
Just the quietness of a library is a freaking gift. It is because it's so noisy on the street. It's noisy at night. It is all these things. And if you are mentally ill, all these things become triggers. And they become triggers in a negative way and not a positive way. So now, as you're doing this story, how do we get librarians to be able to amplify their voice to explain to policymakers what is going on? Again, that line, there are more libraries as a place of refuge than there are homeless shelters. It is why they're found. It is why they serve so many different purposes. And you want librarians to be able to say, we want to serve everyone. But the purpose of serving everyone wasn't that we were supposed to be the homeless shelter replacement.
Right.
It doesn't mean the homeless don't have a shelter with us.
The sanctuary of last resort.
So I'm just trying to figure out, because they really are the canary in the coal mine. And to a large extent, I think their voices are even more profound because they do exist everywhere. So they probably see it in a much more intimate way.
Well, I would say that part of this has to do with taking back the national narrative to reflect the circumstance of the American people. And that has to do with reporting that is granular, that is based on a particular place and circumstance. And that means that, you know, the librarians, you know, as you know, as being a, I don't know, do you say you're an unsuccessful politician?
Or no, I'm a politician. No, I describe myself as a politician in recovery.
That's
totally
like
perfect.
That.
Don't you think so?
Yeah,
I thought so. Unsuccessful. Knuckle sandwich.
So the thing here is that in order to make this count and to have this be something that's discussed, we need to build coalition. And so the current circumstance in the United States is that the homeless folks and who are underserved are become the charges of law enforcement, police officers.
Right.
EMTs, we've spoken about the tremendous pay disparity with EMTs, emergency medical technicians, and then also people that are working in corrections. And none of these people, and I speak with many, many, many of them, are committed, compassionate professionals who nothing makes them sadder than being part of a system where they can't make a difference. And so the thing to do is make sure that these professional associations, in addition to talking about their benefits and about their, you know, retirement plans and the benefits, that this now become an articulatable agenda item for all of the people that are in these various professions around the country, to begin to have Congress address in a meaningful way the support systems that these institutions need to make a difference in the lives of these people. Who may have all sorts of, you know, many of them are veterans who served our country.
Right.
Many of them are individuals who whose lives were working, and because of a twist and turn of a series of unrelated events, found themselves on the street. And so, I mean, one of the problems, and I'm working on a story right now for the chief related to this, is it's not that we're not spending money to address it. There are billions of dollars being spent around the country to deal with homelessness, but unfortunately, what happens is it develops into what I call homeless ink. Entities, nonprofits that are making a fortune to keep these people in the squalid circumstance they find them because they figured out how to make hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, the other thing that you've got homeless ink, but then you also have jails. And so when you begin, and the numbers in your piece about jails are so important, because I want people to hear this, because when you realize about how they've now become the repository of really so many people with so many mental health issues, and think about this. So they're mixed with the general population. There's a significant part of that population that is mentally ill. You train prison guards, but what are you training them in? They're not mental health counselors. And just share with my audience, I mean, your last paragraph I posted on my Facebook page because I was just so shocked about it. You begin by writing, by September 2016, things had gotten even more acute in the nation's jails. So, Bob, share with my audience some of these numbers, because I think people need
around,
to know.
Not looking at it, but it's around 15% of the some odd rough number, 2 million individuals that are incarcerated are severely mentally ill. So you're talking about a cohort in the 300,000 range of people who do not belong where they are and are not getting the treatment that's required and pose a danger to themselves and to other people.
But this is important. You have, this is from a white paper from the Treatment Advocacy Center. Now listen to this number, everyone. In point, in fact, the L.A. County Jail or the Chicago Cook County Jail or New York's Riker Island Jail, just take any one of these jails, each one of these jails holds more mentally ill inmates than any of the remaining psychiatric hospitals in the United States. So you take the psychiatric hospitals and you add them all up, and one freaking jail, one jail has more people that are mentally ill than all the psychiatric hospitals. So what does that tell you? It tells you that they have become the dumping ground for mental illness. But because we don't know how to deal with them, New Hampshire knows this story way too well. Trust me about this. I want to send this article to Rennie Cushing, who's been fighting for the fact that we literally now don't have a secure psychiatric facility. Where do they go? They go to jail. They go to jail because we don't have a secure psychiatric facility. So these are the kinds of stories. And then your last line is, so if they don't end up in jail or if they don't find a place in a secure psychiatric facility, you write, but there's always the library. Oh, my God, Bob, that last line makes me want to cry, because how can we be the wealthiest nation in the world and look at this between our failure in our mental health system and our failure in being able to address the whole idea of housing? Because this is also a mental health issue. It's a housing issue. It's a health care issue. And it's a failure to sort of make the requisite investments at the right time.
Right. And do you notice that we've gone through this entire conversation without mentioning Donald Trump? So that tells you how we're not mustering the attention. And the other numbers in there, another key thing, this country is in crisis. And I say that in terms of data points. We've talked about it before.
Right.
For 3 years in a row, the average life expectancy has declined. That's the first time that's happened since World War One.
Yeah.
Suicides, every cohort, it's an issue. Opioid deaths. By every measure, if we were just to strip the name off of this country and look at that data point, we'd be at the UN saying, well, this seems to be a nation that's having trouble.
Yeah.
And yet we don't even talk about any of it.
Well, I just want, you know, we talk about mental health. And as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, we did mention it because the only time we talk about mental health and it comes out of the mouth of either our president or Republicans in Congress especially is that we talk We talk about it as it relates to the gun epidemic. Okay. So there is a piece, and I just want everyone to know that this is what's so scary here, because I am listening to you discussing this as you know, that now libraries are refuges. We house more in our prisons. But there's a piece at theconversation.com, everyone, and I want you to hear the title of this piece. More mental health care won't stop the gun epidemic, new study suggests. So there is an irony in all this. We use mental health only as we weaponize the inability to take on the gun industry and do anything in the way of gun regulation. The grotesque story about our failure to deal with mental health, which is experienced in our prisons and in our libraries and on our streets, never gets the light of day. So we apply it as the wrong solution, and yet where it clearly needs to be addressed, it is not.
Well, what do they say? It's never good to let a good crisis go to waste.
Exactly. I'm just going to urge everyone, you are a great reporter. I am really glad.
Well, please, I'm also looking for Ed Stuck Nation. That's my Twitter handle. So I also, this is a big country, and you're speaking to much of it,
yeah.
So we crowdsource stories.
Right.
I'm interested in particularly these stories that are related to first responders and civil servants who are trying to do the right thing but find themselves in a circumstance where they can't do the right thing. And it's very important that their voices be amplified.
And if you go to Salon.com, the title of the piece is, "As the Welfare State Decays, Public Libraries Become Sites of Social Trauma. With no commons anymore, many homeless and struggling people find refuge at public libraries." And I'm just going to end with this, Bob. And I keep going back to my conversations with guys in Afghanistan who had served in Afghanistan. And when they got to Afghanistan, one of the guys said to me, "You know, Arnie, I suddenly realized I'm really not in the military. I'm a social service agency." And that's what he said. He suddenly realized he should have taken social work school, because that was what he was actually more called on to do in Afghanistan, was not to use his weapon, but to use his skill set in figuring out how to stabilize communities and help in the sort of social service network that was so frayed as a result of the war. And I'm looking at that, and that's what he was learning. And he was wearing the hat of the military. I'm looking at librarians thinking they're there to shelve books. And what they're finding out is they're there to figure out how to balance these incredibly fragile lives. So thank you so much.
Yeah, they turn out to be. Thank you. Call me anytime.
I will.
Take care.
All right, take care.
Bye.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arnison. Ken Barnes is doing his thing for Yom Kippur. You can't say celebrate. It seems like an inappropriate word. All right, everyone, we're going to do a little labor history next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1823. That was the day abolitionist and women's suffragist Mary Ann Shad Carey was born. Her parents were free blacks of color in the slave state of Delaware. They were involved with many prominent abolitionists and active in the Underground Railroad. The family moved to Pennsylvania, where Mary and her siblings were educated in Quaker schools. As a young woman, Mary became a teacher and returned to Wilmington, Delaware, where she opened a school for black children. Once the Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, Mary and many other free blacks fled to Canada to safely continue their abolitionist work. She opened a school for fugitive slaves in Windsor, Ontario, just across the river from Detroit. Mary soon came under fire in the local press for insisting the school be racially integrated. She responded by starting her own newspaper, the Provincial Freeman. She and her husband Thomas often traveled to the United States to continue their anti-slavery work. They were present at John Brown's 1858 Constitutional Convention. Mary worked with Osborne Perry Anderson to publish his 1861 memoir, A Voice from Harper's Ferry. Anderson had participated in Brown's raid and was the lone African-American survivor. After her husband's death, Mary returned to the United States with her children to help recruit black soldiers for the Union Army. Once the Civil War was over, Mary moved to Washington, D.C. to teach. She enrolled in Howard University, where she earned a law degree. There, she joined the National Women's Suffrage Association and worked with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. She continued to advocate for civil rights and women's equality until her death in 1893.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Jeremy Ornstein first learned about climate change as a child, he was terrified that the world was coming to an end.
I would cover my ears whenever anyone mentioned the words global warming.
As he got older, his fear gave way to frustration with politicians, who he says were not doing enough to avert the climate crisis. After graduating from high school last year, Ornstein took a year off before starting college. He worked full-time with the Sunrise Movement. It's an organization of young activists helping to elect politicians that support ambitious climate action. Ornstein knocked on doors to help elect a new member of the Pennsylvania State Legislature, who opposed the construction of a new fossil fuel pipeline in the state. She ran on the issue and won.
It just goes to show that even when it's an uphill battle, if you talk to people and treat people like they're human beings and have real conversations, then you can win.
Ornstein wants to help other Americans create a future that is good for the planet and its people.
We talk to people about how the future could include them and how their dreams could be included in the future and how we could work together to achieve those. And that feels like not just how we're going to win elections, but how we're going to actually stop this climate crisis and make a better world.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for.
I think they should play this song every time they have a banking hearing in Congress. Don't you think so? This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is celebrating, or he's doing his Yom Kippur thing. And joining us is Fred Portnoy. And this is a Pete Seeger song. Am I correct? Yes, it is. So why did he pick up "The Banks Are Made of Marble"? And that's because he realized that we're going to have Graham Steele on. He is the director of Corporations and Society Initiative at Stanford Graduate School of Business. I think I want to go to school with Graham. The title of his piece at the American Prospect was "Overhaul the Business of Wall Street. Remaking the Financial System Does Not Require Any New Laws." This is part of David Dayan's dream when he became the new executive editor of The Prospect, where he wanted to do something called the Day One Agenda. And I love his dream. And we are actually going to be plowing through everything in The Prospect and taking an interview with each one of these sort of Day One Agenda articles. And the whole point of it is they have identified 30 meaningful executive actions, all derived from authority in specific statutes, which could be implemented on day one, everyone, by a new president. These would not be executive orders, much less abuses of authority, but strategic exercises of legitimate presidential power. Graham Steele, I'm screaming after each paragraph. I'm just telling you right now, going, oh, God, they could do this. Oh, God, they could do that. And let me just say something, Graham. Do you know what this did for me? It broke my heart. And the reason it broke my heart is Barack Obama knew how to bail out Wall Street. And given what you wrote about, the authority that he did not exercise for those 8 years, a pox on us for not having been able to do it. I mean, if nothing else, to balance out, okay, we'll restore you. We'll prop you up after you brought the economy to our knees. But guess what? You know, Dodd-Frank was nothing without the kind of executive authority that could have been exercised by Barack Obama. Welcome to the program, Professor Steele.
Arnie, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. And you're exactly right. You know, there were a lot of opportunities after the financial crisis to remake the financial system completely top to bottom. Didn't need a whole lot of new authority to do it. And if we learned anything, is that when Wall Street is down, that's when you have an opportunity to really do something. But if you let them get back up, they'll go right back to doing the same stuff they always do.
Well, who was it? You mentioned it in your article, and I can never remember the name of the senator, but the senator who, after sort of realizing what was going on, stood up on the floor of the U.S. Senate and said, oh, my God, the banks own this place.
Dick Durbin.
And I to this day, it sort of resonates. And as I was reading this, they do own the place. They own the regulators. They own the lobbyists. And as a result, you're absolutely right. When they were vulnerable, when they were on their knees, was an opportunity to say, okay, we'll give you a handout. We will help you. But as part of your penance, if you at least don't go to jail, which some of them should have, these are the kinds of things you need to do. So literally what I want you to do, Graham, because two things. I want you to walk through your article and share with my listeners exactly the kinds of things that could happen on day one as a result of executive authority, not using any kind of additional privileges, but just with the laws that are currently on the books and the regulations and the authority of the different departments, number one. And number two, I'm going to make a recommendation, and I said this on my Facebook page. Every single 2020 candidate should be sent this article, number one. Number two, I don't know how you can make this happen, but I want Graham Steele to interview every one of the 2020 candidates and walk – no, seriously – and walk through your article and say, would you consider doing this? And if not, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think people need to, one, hear the Q&A to understand that the tremendous amount of authority the executive branch already has. But then I want to hear the excuses as to why not.
Sure, sure. Okay. Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, and I think David did do that with some of these articles, actually put the questionnaires to the candidates to see who was on board with what. And some came around to supporting some of them. Some said they're worth considering. I will also flag that some of these ideas that are already in my article are actually just the regulatory implementation of things that people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have proposed doing through legislation.
Right.
So, I mean, I presume some of them would be on board with some of these things just because they already have bills doing some of this stuff. But it's a good question. I mean, the candidates have not really been put on the record on Wall Street issues so far. We've talked a lot about a lot of really important issues because there are so many important issues out there. But I don't think it's come up once during any of the debates so far is where do you stand on the power of Wall Street and what are you really going to do to help American consumers? So yeah,
let's walk through four or five of the points that you've made in your article so we can literally take them in chunks. I mean, I the one about climate change, oh my God, I went berserk.
Mm-hmm.
I posted that one. But let's not start there. Just walk us through what is currently within the power of the executive branch or the FDIC or, you know, I mean, I just don't think people understand that it's really about prosecutorial discretion is really what I sort of thought about it. It's like you either decide to push the button or ignore the button.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, I had a laundry list of about, I think, 9 or 10 ideas there. I think I have a few more that didn't make it into the article because, you know, there are word limits for it.
Right.
But the overarching point, I mean, you could take any of these things. You could do some of them. You could do other ones that aren't even on that list. But the point is the financial system right now is really bloated and out of control.
Yes.
And it operates on an extractive and a predatory model. And fundamentally, the one thing allowing that to continue to happen is that these regulators who charter these institutions, who give them the ability to operate, who let them have taxpayer backing to do these extractive and predatory businesses, the regulators are allowing them to do that.
So
the first example, the first category that I had there was just what to do about these big and out of control banks.
Yes.
You know, you can break them up. You can downsize them. You can say a bank can't grow larger than X size. You can say we're not going to have banks doing Wall Street speculation anymore. We're going to keep them to core activities like taking in customer deposits and just making loans, and that's it. None of these fancy, esoteric, complex financial products.
Right.
You know, regulators really can rein that stuff in because they were fundamentally the ones that gave the banks the authority to do that stuff in the first place. They had their agency lawyers and the bank lawyers get together and say, well, this activity I want to do over here is kind of like making a loan, so you ought to let me do it. And then they wanted to do another activity and said, well, you let me do, you know, this other activity over here, you gave me approval to do this activity, this new one that I want to do is like the one you approved before. And there was this slow, you know, once you get the camel's nose under the tent, it keeps going under there more and more and more. And those were all done by the regulators through, honestly, letters, not even rules necessarily, a letter from an agency lawyer to a bank lawyer. Someone could come into one of these agencies and repeal a bunch of those letters and get banks back to doing the kind of plain vanilla stuff you think about lending to Main Street businesses and things like that.
Well, I've always said this to my audience. This is what I remember about the banker. And you talk about it as banks should be boring. Hallelujah. And I'm going to use my own personal life story. My personal life story is my brother. My brother was very, very bright, went to law school, but decided he wanted to be reasonably affluent, didn't want the stress of law. So what did he go into 40 years ago? Banking. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason he went into banking was he would never get wildly rich, but he would be comfortably rich, and that mm-hmm. banking was boring. Okay. Mm-hmm. You took in deposits, you know, you sat down with a client and said, no, you're not ready for a mortgage yet. You got to earn more money. Where's the 20% down? You know, mm-hmm. bankers weren't about yes. They're about maybe yes, but not yet. I mean, mm-hmm. that was that. Well, my brother right now is wildly successful. I mean, he can buy and sell countries, okay? He owns more houses than you would know, and I won't tell you the kind of cars he drives. That was not the plan at the very beginning, okay? That was mm-hmm. not the plan. But what changed in banking made him wildly rich, but who ultimately got hurt for banks becoming so incredibly financially successful for them was us. And mm-hmm. I think when you begin to realize what happened to consumers, what happened to people is that, you know, they developed a level of expertise and came up with products that you and I could never understand. Frankly, they didn't understand, but they could make money and we would be basically made more vulnerable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the problem with this, the model of the kind of Wall Street model where banks are these financial supermarkets is you want a model where the bank and the customer grow and benefit profit together. And the
yes.
problem is that when you have the out of control financial sector, the financial sector succeeds at the expense of everybody else. And that's really the problem. And that's the key thing, I think, across the theme of the article
exactly.
is it's really going after the predatory models, be it Wall Street banks, be it private equity, be it discriminatory lending.
Yep.
I mean, that's the problem is when finance becomes a leech sucking on the rest of the economy rather than providing capital for the rest of the economy to grow. So that's exactly right. I mean, you mentioned the climate crisis.
Yes, let's talk about that because I was – so let me just say something. So if when I think of climate crisis, I decided that the only time I ever love insurance companies is the climate crisis. And that is because insurance companies say, uh-uh, I'm not insuring you. Or they say, here, we're sending you a bill. Quadruple what your last bill was because they recognize the consequences of climate crisis. Even if regulators won't, even if politicians won't, they do because they have the numbers, they're the actuarial tables, and they're looking at what's actually happening. And they're saying, I am not going to insure you because you are too vulnerable to climate. And as a result, these are the consequences. But you mentioned what banks can do. So share with my audience, connect the dots between banking and the climate crisis because this was for me a come to Jesus moment. I'm like, wow, this is very interesting.
Sure, yeah. You know, it's a thing that students here at the business school here are realizing when they want to go into finances, and I think more and more the public is coming around to this idea, is that what we decide as a society or as a business to finance is a statement of our values.
Yes.
And that fossil fuels and deforestation would not be permitted to continue if financiers, large financial institutions, be they the large banks, be they asset managers, honestly, be they even insurers, when they're making investments to pay out to their policyholders, if they weren't directing massive amounts of capital into fossil fuel, oil and gas, coal, deforestation through agribusinesses, the kinds of beef companies that are right now deforesting the Amazon basin
exactly.
in Brazil.
Exactly.
Those businesses would not be allowed to continue if Wall Street decided, you know what, this is too much of a risk, both financially of what could happen if there's a carbon bubble that bursts at some point,
mm-hmm.
but also just what it means, the cost that it's going to impose on the rest of our society in terms
exactly.
of, you know, losses from extreme weather events, mass migration, things like that. Banking agencies really do have the ability to say to these financial institutions, you know what, your financing, your provision of capital, these industries is really dangerous for us, both on a social level, but also on a financial level. We want you to get out of these businesses. And that would, you know, people talk a lot in the context of the Green New Deal about the need to create things like green banks to really ramp up financing of new green technologies to get to zero carbon emissions, but they're going to be those institutions are going to be competing against the largest Wall Street banks that are
right.
pumping. I think the number that I said
700 billion. I have it right in front
right.
of me.
So exactly, and those are just from the six or eight largest banks alone. To say nothing of the $1 trillion asset managers and large insurance companies as well. They'll all be if they're still pumping capital into these industries. That's a lot for the government to compete with in trying to ramp up new clean energy technology.
I want to read this paragraph because I want everyone to hear every word. Maybe no activity is more unsafe and unsound than the largest U.S. financial institutions' investment in businesses that are significant drivers of climate change. And you mentioned the number, but I want people to hear the number in context. Over the past 3 years, un, deux, trois, the six largest U.S. banks provided over $700 billion in fossil fuel financing. Large banks and asset managers are also making investments in companies. You mentioned driving deforestation, including the Amazon. And you go through all this, and this really is a very real risk. And that's the problem. It is the definition of risk. It is the definition of unsound. You know, I always tell people, I used to teach mass communication, and I said, here's the problem. If I have a lens and I put my lens on a little dot, you would think the only thing I'm looking at is red because that's the color of the dot. If I widen my lens, you suddenly realize that the dot is actually on a tablecloth with lots of different colors. If I keep widening my lens, I suddenly realize I'm talking about a kitchen, okay? This is what I'm looking at. And that is the whole problem. It is the decision of the regulators, how wide a lens they choose to look at. And if they look at a lens that's wide enough, they do have, I think, the language to say, this is unsound. This is risky. You cannot do this.
Absolutely. And I mean, unsurprisingly, Europe is doing this. They're going through this right now, yes, where regulators in Europe are saying there are significant financial risks if we allow the climate to continue on the path that it's on if we don't get to zero emissions eventually. So other countries, unsurprisingly, are doing it. It's our own administration and its climate of denial around climate change that's allowing banks to still stay in these businesses and not taking the kind of aggressive action that's happening over in places like England.
So why does Wells Fargo still exist? I mean, it's so funny. As I'm reading your, I eventually see that you mentioned Wells Fargo. But as I'm reading your article, I'm going, Wells Fargo. My middle fingers are up in stereo. Wells Fargo. And then, of course, we get to Wells Fargo. So tell me, why haven't people done a perp walk? How does Wells Fargo continue to exist? How do we keep, like, you know, I mean, when you charge a bank with a fine, that's just the cost of doing business. What really scares executives is not a check that the bank can write, that they can't even write off sometimes off their taxes. It's, you know, what they look like in an orange jumpsuit. And I'm just trying to figure out, what is it that made it so impossible for us to realize that the consequence of this enormous risk that happened in 2008 is that somebody should have actually gone to jail? We can send a kid who, you know, robs a 7-Eleven to jail. We just can't send someone to jail who robs a nation.
Well, that's right. I think, I mean, The crisis was full of so many bad acts and so many bad actors that it's one of those things where everyone's to blame and so no one's to blame in
yes.
a situation like that,
yes.
I think. But, you know, it's a good point. I have a proposal in this piece about ways to specifically hold the highest executives accountable. There was a law passed after the Enron scandal that made executives specifically certify that all of their accounting and their internal controls around the bank not engaging in wrongdoing, to certify that they were adhering to the highest standards and that wrongdoing was not being committed within their institutions. That law has never really been used. It's on the books. Enforcers could actually use that to go after top CEOs and say, you told us things were going well in your bank.
Right.
You lied to us. You know, one of the ways that a lot of these institutions, and Wells Fargo is a good example of this, one of the ways that the executives get away with these kinds of activities is that they can kind of say, well, it was happening at a low level. It was a few bad apples.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah, people told me a little bit about what was going on, but I didn't believe them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a way of diffusing responsibility. When bonus time comes around, they take credit for all of the
right.
fake accounts that are sold. They take
exactly.
credit for the share price going up. But then when bad things happen, they diffuse the responsibility away and say, well, I didn't know what was happening. But it was the regional manager's fault. No,
right.
it was a few, you know, they blame tellers making minimum wage at these branches and fire, you know, a few thousand of them.
Exactly.
But they don't take responsibilities themselves. So I think they use these laws, regulators don't use the laws they have at their disposal.
Thank you.
Executives use this diffusion of responsibility. And again, I mean, to get back to the point about regulators not really having the political will to go after these institutions, it's the same on the prosecutorial side. Did not have the will, either for the reasons of political economy, maybe because they were eventually going to go back and work at a large corporate law firm.
Right.
you know, did not pursue these executives who could have been held accountable after the financial crisis. And so, I mean, you know, this that impunity has consequences. Look at our president. He's acting with impunity right now. And I think the failure to hold white-collar executives accountable has a lot of repercussions, some of them foreseen, but some of them unforeseen.
So the threat of lawsuit is usually one of the reasons why regulators tend to be reluctant and drag their knuckles. But you actually think that the threat of lawsuit or going to court is not a bad thing, even if we have bad judges, because it's an opportunity to sort of draw attention to what in fact happened, to expose it to the public, to put people on the record, to let people know what's going on. I think that's the other thing. I keep wanting my radio station to sell a bumper sticker, and the title of the bumper sticker is "A Spine is a Terrible Thing to Waste." And the more I read your piece, I kept thinking I'm definitely selling this bumper sticker, because really we are so afraid of the potential of possibly losing the court hearing, but not realizing that there is value in exposing the rot.
Yeah, there is. I mean, when you don't have that fight, you unilaterally disarm yourself.
Exactly.
They get the same ultimate outcome as they would have if it gets overturned in court, or if Congress passes a law overturning your rule. The outcome is the same. You haven't gotten the policy enacted that you wanted to get enacted. But when you actually pick that fight, you draw attention to the issue, you extract a political cost from it, you raise people's consciousness about it, and you might not win the first one,
right.
You might not win the second one, but that dynamic changes over time, and we've honestly seen it in the Congress, not necessarily in the courts, but in the Congress. You know, a few years ago, it used to be okay to just quietly in the dark do the bidding of the banks and
right.
give them handouts and giveaways, but, you know, over the last decade, members have been having those fights and pushing back against the bipartisan gifts to Wall Street, and that political calculus has been changing. And again, it draws a contrast. Whose side are you on here? Are you on the side of the taxpayers
exactly.
and the consumers?
Exactly.
Are you on the side of the Wall Street banks? And
exactly.
as I say in the piece, that's a fight that
is worth
people
having.
Ought to welcome. Yeah,
yes,
it is. It clarifies
is.
A lot.
So I, when I was a fellow at Harvard, I was given Bella Abzug's office and her old office, and there was a great quote from Bella, and I think everybody should hold on to this quote. And the quote from Bella is, you have to lose, lose, lose to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I want people to understand, don't be afraid of losing. Be afraid of not trying. Be afraid
yep.
of not establishing the record. Be afraid of not putting people on the record about how they believe. But one of the world sort of, I want to sort of end with this, because
mm-hmm.
you did point out that a number of these people will continue in their positions of authority that Trump appointed into 2023, that they will be there for a long time. So what happens when you have the CFPB being run by someone who doesn't necessarily care about what the CFPB should do, or the FDIC? How do you deal with the fact that the regulators are going to be stuck till 2023 because of Trump? Their idea of regulating is not really what the new executive's idea of regulating is.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so I think there are a couple problems there. I think the first is it's important that the next administration begins now building the case that these people aren't fit to be in those offices. These
okay.
people can be removed, but you have to meet a legal standard in order to do it, to show that there is neglect or there's malfeasance in the office. So, for example, you know, the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a bureau that was created to protect consumers. There's been lots of great reporting on this, ProPublica and others,
yeah.
about the agency essentially being in the pocket of the payday lenders, one of the most predatory, worst consumer financing industries you can possibly think of. You know, if that's not neglect and malfeasance in office doing the bidding of this really predatory industry, I don't know what is.
Right.
So one thing is to start building the case that a lot of these people have to go if there's a new administration that comes in there. That's the first step. The second step is to have a plan of what happens if Democrats aren't in control of the Senate, because that's really important too. I think people need to go into a new administration clear-eyed that if Mitch McConnell is still in charge of the Senate,
right.
I don't know how many votes he's going to allow in administration nominees, but it's not going to be many.
Right.
So they need to think about how to reshuffle some of the personnel, how to put people in temporary positions that don't need Senate confirmation. It's wonky and it's pretty boring, but it's really important to actually get these agencies to run properly and to get the mandate of the president and their agenda enacted. As I use a quote in there, a thing that Senator Warren's likes to say a lot, which is personnel is policy. You need, yes. need to think a lot about how to get their personnel in place to enact the policies they want.
So, Graham, given the direction that we're going in now after the 2008 economic meltdown, are we back at the same place? Before, like, are we, even despite the fact we had Dodd-Frank, even despite the fact that we did create some kind of regulatory framework, are you concerned that really what we've done is by draining so much out of it, by not making the enforcement that we needed, by seeing these banks now that are actually bigger and more, in some ways, more financially successful than they were before, are you concerned that, you know, where we are today seems and smells very similar to where we were before the meltdown?
Sure. I want to be clear about Dodd-Frank. I mean, it didn't do a lot. There are a lot of areas where it didn't actually make meaningful structural change, but it gave new authorities. And some of those were useful. Creating a new consumer bureau, that was a useful thing. That was good. It did regulate some previously unregulated markets. So there were some benefits to it. I think the really important thing, though, is that those tools only matter if someone good is using them and we're backsliding. And so in terms of the regulator's approach, I mean, some of the people who are in charge now were actually in charge before the crisis even happened, yeah. and they're doing and saying the same things now that they were saying back then.
I need to let you go. Thank you.
I really think a lot of the important lessons weren't learned, and I think we are definitely at risk.
Sit down with every presidential candidate. Graham Steele is the director of Corporations and Society Initiative at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Previously, he was the minority chief counsel for the Senate Banking Committee. You are a great teacher. It's a wonderful article. And part of the reason why I want people to sit down with you and to address these issues is that it's an education in what is possible. That's mm-hmm. what's so exciting about it. Plus, it educates in what we haven't done. And if you feel vulnerable still today, understand that there are ways of making change, and you don't have to get it through Congress. You just need to have the right executive making sure that enforcement happens. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie. Really appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome. And we end with The Wall Street Part of Town. Ooh, I think I like this song. Was it Ry Cooder?